The new program aims to boost outreach to rural Arkansans living with diabetes. The University of Arkansas rings in the Year of the Horse. And Arkansas may be a landlocked state, but what lurks below the surface may shark you. Those stories and more are coming up this week on the News Wrap from the Arkansas Newsroom. I'm Daniel Breen, News Director of Little Rock Public Radio. Each week, we're recapping the top stories from all across the natural state. We'll unpack the headlines, share exclusive insights, and provide the context you need to fully grasp the issues that matter most to Arkansans. That's this week on the Arkansas News Wrap, coming up right after the news from NPR. This is the Arkansas News Wrap. I'm Daniel Breen with Little Rock Public Radio. New research suggests Arkansas, a famously landlocked state, was once full of sharks. A study published in the journal GeoBios suggests the geologic formation known as the Fayetteville Shale was once home to a plethora of sharks. That's now taken the form of several fossilized shark remains dating as far back as 326 million years ago. Allison Bronson is an evolutionary ichthyologist at Cal Poly Humboldt, and she spoke with Little Rock Public Radio's Maggie Ryan.
This is a shale that's been really well studied by oil geologists for many, many years, and has also been really valuable for studying invertebrate fossils, particularly ammonites, which are a lot, they're sort of like a nautilus, related to squid and octopus. But there are lots and lots of fish fossils that have been collected from the Fayetteville Shale for many decades now, which are only being addressed over the last 10, 15 years. And we've been able to study them using CT scanning, and it's showing us that these fish have three-dimensionally preserved skeletons. Sharks and their relatives are made of cartilage, and their skeletons, being cartilaginous, normally break down before they can fossilize. And then all you have left in the fossil record are teeth. And so these well-preserved skeletons that we're finding are so unique in this formation, that resource of having three-dimensionally preserved fossil cartilage has enabled us to use these fossils to study things like evolution of sharks more broadly, which groups are related to which, studying the evolution of different structures in their anatomy over time. And all of that we now understand to be possible because of the environment in which these fossils were preserved.
So before this, there wasn't a lot of understanding of what the ancestors of sharks, of modern day sharks, what they looked like, basically. Just explain that a little bit more. Like, how does this help? How is this helping researchers?
There's a lot of work that has been done for sure on where sharks came from, who they're related to more broadly. And we know that sharks come from bony ancestors. So they're not, despite having cartilaginous skeletons, sharks are not primitive vertebrates. They are super specialized fishes that over time have this reduced cartilaginous skeleton that evolved from heavy bony skeletons. But the relationships within that group of cartilaginous fishes are still under debate. So one of the primary groups of sharks found in this site are these weird fish called simoriforms. They're these freaky looking extinct, completely extinct sharks that had all kinds of weird appendages on their bodies and spines in crazy places. And there's like a treasure trove of these simoriform group fossils here. And so some of them have given us things like the most complete gill structures found in a shark of this age that we can use to confirm that sharks came from bony relatives. They basically have gill arches that look like bony fish gill arches. There's one we described last year that has a gill cover that sort of looks like a gill cover on a ratfish, which is a weird group of fish alive today, or kind of more like a bony fish really than what you'd see in a modern shark. And there are even, among all these weird fossil, these obscure fossil groups, there are some fossils here that have transitional features where they look a little bit like one group and a little bit like another. And so they're extra valuable for studies of these groups' evolution, where we basically assign codings to all of these different anatomical traits that we can see in the fossils and then run them through computer analyses that reconstruct evolutionary relationships.
Tell me a little bit more about the CT scanning process. Just talk a little bit about that.
Basically, a few decades ago, people got the great idea to apply CT scanning to studying anatomy of plants and animals and all kinds of different things. And it has absolutely exploded in popularity. So just from the time when I was a graduate student to now, I feel like CT scanning has really ushered in this like renaissance of anatomy and morphology, because you don't destroy your specimens to study them. Whereas in the past, the only way to look at the internal anatomy of a fossil was to section through it. And so the most beautiful anatomical studies all had to be done by grinding away section after section after section of these fish skulls and drawing what was inside or making a wax model of it. And now, which obviously, but destroys your best specimen, right? And then all you have are these little slices that you reconstructed. So now, instead of spending months to years doing that, you can make a CT scan in an hour and then reconstruct that anatomy on the computer over a period of months without destroying your specimen and see all of this incredibly detailed anatomy inside.
There were a lot of shark fossils found in the shale. What about other fish? Were there other fish that have been found here?
In our paper, we describe a couple of bony fish fossils, including scales of these really big extinct fishes called rhizodonts. But there aren't as many as you would expect. This period of time, which is called the Mississippian, falls after one of the biggest vertebrate mass extinctions in Earth's history. But by this period of time, following that extinction, these major groups of fishes have diversified. And we see all these major groups like lobe-finned and ray-finned bony fishes and sharks that you see the descendants of swimming around today. And yet we did not find very many bony fishes here. So that was one of the little mysteries of this project as well, is where are the bony fossils? Why do we have so much cartilage and so little bone? And the results of what we found indicate that this had what we'd call a reducing environment and a very anoxic environment. And so you can think of it as like low oxygen, high acidity, basically. So bone and shell were being broken down fairly quickly, and the cartilage was actually more frequently being preserved. So it's not that there weren't any bony fishes swimming around in this site at that time, but they were just a little less likely to be preserved than the sharks were.
Have fossils like this been found anywhere else?
Yes. So for this particular period of time, this is about 326 million years old, the Fayetteville Shale is really the best place for finding this kind of fossil cartilage. But just a little bit older and younger, there are more amazing cartilage fossils elsewhere in the world. So there have been some really gorgeous fossils from Morocco that have helped us to understand shark evolutionary relationships, as well as there's the famous Bear Gulch formation in Montana that has really bizarre, amazing body fossils of cartilaginous fishes. And so these things are a little younger, a little older, but cartilage around the world, there are fossils of it. It's hard to find, there's not that much, but they're out there.
What does finding like this mean for future research with the Fayetteville Shale Formation?
It means a couple of different things, I think. So on one hand, this is like, okay, we understand why we're getting these beautiful skeletons, and it helps us to understand why this place is so special. In the longer term, knowing a little bit more about the depositional environment and the chemistry of these fossils being preserved might help us to target other locations in the world where we can start looking for fossil cartilage. There are a lot of people on this paper, including our friend Pierre, who studies, he uses synchrotron technology to study the chemical and geological aspects of fossils. And our colleague Ben studies lobe-finned fishes. And our colleague Neil studies ammonites. And so, like many, many studies, in paleontology, but in science in general, the best part is that you get to work with your friends. And so, so I think being able to go in the field, work in the lab, and then write papers with people that have a similar appreciation for deep time and weird animals is just by far the best part of the job.
That was Allison Bronson, evolutionary ichthyologist at Cal Poly Humboldt, speaking with Little Rock Public Radio's Maggie Ryan. A study from the University of Arkansas for Medical Sciences shows providing a telehealth option for diabetes education can significantly improve outcomes for those with type 2 diabetes. The study also compares two different models of diabetes self-management education and support programs, or DSMES. The standard model is individual-based, while the other is family-based. Jennifer Anderson is an assistant professor at UAMS's Institute for Community Health Innovation and is also living with type 1 diabetes. She tells KUAF's Matthew Moore that the typical procedure is that once a person is diagnosed, they'll go to their doctor's office to receive their DSMES.
Which makes it so that you have to drive somewhere to go get that education. This study is different because we administered DSME, so diabetes self-management education and support, via telehealth in two different models. We did our standard DSME, which is just the person themselves going to classes, in this case online, and learning the material that way. The other way that we did this was through family DSME. So that is the person with diabetes and a family member of their choosing who go to the class together. So both people are getting that education, both folks are setting the goals for what they are going to do to help manage the person with diabetes blood sugar. So that's a little different, both in the fact that it's telehealth delivered, which means you don't have to drive anywhere, and also because a portion of the participants had that family member support in the classroom.
Why was that important?
So if you think about it, when one person in the household is diagnosed with diabetes, they need to make certain changes to their lifestyle. So things like eating more whole foods, eating less processed sugar, increasing their activity levels to be able to help get that blood glucose, the blood sugar, back under control. When you are the only person in the household who's doing that, it can be really hard for other people to understand what you are experiencing and why. Being able to bring a family member into that situation so they are getting the knowledge and learning how that works too has the ability, which our study ended up showing, to increase helpful behavior on the family member's part. So being able to have the family member do things like help fix healthier meals, hang out with the kids while you go out for a walk, or walking with the person with diabetes, things like that. So it's an interesting piece that you don't get in that standard diabetes education.
I feel like an element of this is indirectly helping to create empathy for people in your life in this way too.
Indirectly, yeah. I mean, it is one of those things where if you just don't know what you don't know. So being able to have family members learn alongside the person with diabetes is a great way of being able to do that.
In the study, you talk about some elements of there are ways that there can be some harmful family behaviors, ways that, perhaps someone who is ignorant or doesn't understand the way that their behaviors can affect someone with diabetes. Do you have some examples of that, or ways that people can be mindful of their family members who have diabetes?
I mean, I will even give you kind of a personal anecdote just because I've seen it in a situation where, say, there is a birthday party and there are cupcakes there and somebody says, It's okay. It's one time you can have that cupcake, but you're walking into that room knowing that your glucose is high that day, or you're just not sure that it's something that you want to eat because people have that agency to make those choices. Having that pressure can feel very negative. And a lot of times the family member doesn't re necessarily recognize that as harmful, whereas the person can feel like that's a lot of pressure to do something that maybe they feel is not right for them at that time.
A big element of this is the telehealth portion of the education. Obviously, there's some great attributes to it, and the fact that you're talking about you don't have to drive, 30 minutes one way to go to a doctor's office to get this sort of education, to get this sort of help. But one struggle that happens oftentimes with rural parts of Arkansas is reliable internet, and being able to access telehealth in a way that, if you're doing a video conference, are you going to have enough bandwidth to be able to pull that off? How have you seen that challenge play out in your research?
We actually, when we decided to do this, we made it a point to ensure that people had access to internet-capable devices and internet if they needed it. And a lot of times that is cellular. I do know there are certain parts of Arkansas where getting cell service is really hard. We did not note that near as much, but there always will be a certain percentage of participants where this may not necessarily be feasible without some additional assistance in getting access to internet or internet-capable devices.
I don't know if your study found any data related to this, but I'm curious if this sort of family-oriented education process is potentially helping those who may be predisposed to type 2 diabetes, who may, be on the cusp of being pre-diabetic themselves, and these sorts of, this education and this changing of a lifestyle in a familial setting is helping to keep them healthier too.
Those results are not published yet, but it is very promising. So we are seeing that there are signals there that the family DSMEs, because we know that type 2 diabetes has some genetic components, right? So if one person in the household has it, it's likely that somebody else within the household may develop it at some point if they don't already have it. So having that family member there and giving them the skills, possibly before they are even pre-diabetic or have been diagnosed as having diabetes, is something that is really important to be able to have that come across.
We've talked about the demographic group of rural people. When we think about another demographic style of people, we think of maybe Marshallese community or the Hispanic Latino community here in Northwest Arkansas. Are we seeing similar results regardless of race or ethnicity?
We are seeing similar results. One thing I will note is that the family DSMES actually came out of work that we did with the Marshallese community, where the family DSMES, because of the cultural significance of family within the Marshallese community, it actually works sometimes even a little bit better because there is that family component and people are able to work together.
So, study has been published. What's next? How do you anticipate things looking different or changing in the work that happens in this world?
So what we would like to see next is to, because one of the concerns that has happened, because this was one of the first studies that ever looked at telehealth and compared standard DSMES and family DSMES, and we were able to show that the two programs operate similarly. We were able to do it within the accreditation that's required for DSMES programs. It had high fidelity, meaning that both programs were done well within approximately the same time periods, is being able to see both standard and family DSMES programs be covered by insurance, and being able to see the use of telehealth expand in this area so that we can get the services to people where they are, where they need them, without having to add the extra burden of having to travel to the nearest city center to be able to get that care.
That was Jennifer Anderson, assistant professor at the UAMS Institute for Community Health Innovation, speaking with KUAF's Matthew Moore. Tuesday was the start of the Lunar New Year. The School of Art at the University of Arkansas celebrated the holiday by hosting a Lunar New Year Fest. Alice J. Lee is an endowed associate professor of graphic design and organized the event. She spoke with KUAF's Jack Travis.
Just to celebrate the dynamism and the richness that I believe that this community reflects, and to be able to celebrate it together and openly. And so I want this to be a joyful celebration of everyone in this community. I want to be able to connect this part of the campus to the main part of the campus, and to connect the university to the larger community and area. And so we've been able to invite several community organizations as well as student and university organizations so that they can hopefully interact with new people, get the word out in terms of what they're doing, and engage people that maybe it's been a little bit hard for them to get in touch with. And so really want to showcase the richness of the community here. Asian Studies is a program in the university, and they offer really interesting courses, and they can be cross-listed with other departments. So, for example, I will be teaching in the fall of this year a course on the Korean alphabet, and so it'll be cross-listed with graphic design as well as Asian Studies. And so hoping, again, to really connect what we do here in the School of Art, you know, with the other departments of the university, as well as to be a place of celebration and creativity and hopefully safety for the community. We have student groups from the Japanese Student Association, the Korean Student Association. We had this wonderful live dance performance by Te Moana Otea, which is a local Tahitian dance group. And we also have the Chinese American Northwest Arkansas Association doing beautiful calligraphy. And we have the Korean Student Association, as well as AIGA, which is a student graphic design organization. And then, of course, our School of Art Outreach and Recruitment is also here representing. I was born here in the States, but I'm a second-generation Korean-American, so my parents immigrated here from South Korea, and my parents both have lunar birthdays because that was how, back in the day, they tracked birthdays and tracked time when my parents were growing up. And so for me, I really love this idea of how different cultures create systems of organization, and I also love that the Lunar New Year is kind of this confluence of so many cultures and religions. So it's Fat Tuesday, right? And it's also going to be Ramadan tonight, and the Lunar New Year. So I think there's actually quite a lot of connection that happens around the Lunar New Year. And so for me personally, you know, it comes from my culture, but I think I realized through this planning that, wow, like this is something that actually connects quite a lot of groups of people across the world.
That was Alice J. Lee, Associate Professor of Graphic Design at the University of Arkansas, speaking with KUAF's Jack Travis. And that's it for this week. The Arkansas News Wrap is brought to you by the Arkansas Newsroom, a collaboration between KUAF in Fayetteville, KASU in Jonesboro, and Little Rock Public Radio. You can find this week's episode on any of our station's websites. Until next time, I'm Daniel Brain, and this is the Arkansas News Wrap.